being that we just entered the 3 weeks of semi-mourning and mourning that lead up to Tisha B'Av, this Shabbos was the 17th of Tammuz, which, as you, I'm sure you're aware, was a date which signaled the beginning of many, a period during which many tragedies took place as Jewish people, leading up to Tisha B'Av, which is the date of the destruction of both temples, even bigger tragedies. So let's see if we can try and understand a bit about this period and the mourning that goes with it, or some of the reasons for why this is such a black period in Jewish history. And then let's see if we can try and understand some of the correction that we need to do for such a problem. The mystery of it, that's the historical side, the explicit side. The mysterious aspect of this is that it seems that somehow from the sadness of it is where we take out the happiness. In other words, to try and get into the uplift of Elul and Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, the happy time, the uplifting time of year. So it seems there's a Kabbalistic tradition that the only way we can get there is through the sad times. For some reason, so you can try and understand that, it seems that only if you can go through the darkness, then you can see the light afterwards. We know that in these 3 weeks now, we have there's an idea that in the 3 weeks we have the Haftarahs that we read on Shabbos are descriptions of tragedy, of destruction. They are called the Gimel de Puranusa, which means the three that deal with Puranus means tragedy, disasters, something like that, yeah. Then you have afterwards the seven that are called Zayin de Nechemta, which means the seven of Nechama. Nechama means consolation. It's like what you do with a mourner when you visit the Alani, when you go visit someone who's mourning, what you try to do, you try to bring them Nechama. Nichum Aveli means to comfort them somehow. So the conventional idea is that the way you comfort someone is you take his mind off it. That's our concept of mourning, the way you try and make the person feel a bit better as you speak about nonsense, and you so bamboozle him with people coming in and out having tea and making him provide meals and all that nonsense. That's not the way a person's supposed to, you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to sit there absolutely silently, and if the person wants to speak, he speaks, and if he doesn't, he doesn't speak, and you just leave. That's the Jewish way of Nachum Avel. Maybe you shouldn't even eat there at all. But the idea, what that process is supposed to do, not to distract the person so he doesn't remember anymore, that's not going to help anybody. But if you try and take a person's mind at a time when he needs to be dwelling on that kind of process and working it out, you take his mind off that, it'll hurt him worse later. So how do you comfort the person? By making him think about the tragedy? That's no comfort either. But the Kabbalistic idea is that the depth of comfort is to show how the tragedy is part of the reconstruction. The tragedy, the darkness, is part of seeing the light afterwards. That's a very hard message to get right. It's very hard to be able to convey that. It's very hard for a person in that situation to be able to feel that. There's a seat over here. There's a seat. You don't have to stand. There's a seat. The secret is somehow that the Jewish genius of this kind of situation is to be able to snatch out of tragedy. That's what our history is, really. Kabbalists say that there hasn't been one good day, really. There hasn't really been one good day. The first day of human history, the only human who was around, or the two of them, they lost it. They lost it. It wasn't even a day that ended, not even the first day ended, not even one night that people slept peacefully without having wrecked what was given to them. It says the night the Beis HaMikdash was built, Shlomo HaMelech ruled for 40 years in peace. Even then it says that night there was something wrong with the celebrations. He married the daughter of Paroi and something went wrong over there. And that night it says Gabriel, the angel, planted a stake in the Mediterranean, and on that was accreted the country, the great country of Rome, it says, which later caused the destruction of the temple. In other words, the night that the temple was consecrated, the night it was built, already then was laid the seeds of its own destruction. But not even that night, not hard to find a time in Jewish history. I'm not sure you could find even a day when things went right. But the Jewish genius is that we somehow snatch out of the painful aspects of our history our survival, and finally the ultimate level of redemption, of salvation. That's a hard thing to understand. The way you see it is that we know that every system, we know that every system of spiritual, every spiritual framework, let's say, every spiritual system consists of 10 mystical elements. So we know that whenever you find 10, you're looking at a spiritually complete entity. And we know we have 10 elements from the beginning of Tammuz, from this time of Tammuz, when these 3 weeks begin, plus the 7 weeks of Nechama, of Nechamta, that take you through to the happy times, that forms 10. So it's a strange thing. It means that these 10 units are formed by 3 things that are disastrous and 7 things that are a recovery. But it seems that they're one unit. The spiritual message is that the 7 level, the 7 elements that are spiritually, let's say, upward or spiritually elevating, they only come because they've been 3 weeks that were disastrous before. So the conventional understanding is that you just do your best to forget the 3 and then you live in the 7. In other words, the tragedies and the bad times, those are just to be forgotten. Those are just to be written off. Then there's positive times, and that's where you live. But you see, it's not that way at all. It's not the Jewish approach. The Jewish approach is that you don't have the 10 unless you have the 3 that are bad and the 7 that are good. You can't have 7 that are good without the 3 that are tragedies. That's the strange paradoxical message of the Jewish approach to life, is how to live through those times that are negative and extract out of those times the positive times. But just to, that sounds nice in theory. We want to understand what it means in practice. So the scenario a person has to think of is that somebody's in mourning. Somebody's in mourning. That's a time when we're supposed to be comforting the person by showing them that somehow it fits into a scheme. Not by avoiding the issue, but by somehow dwelling on the issue in some way, that this is some kind of a correction, or somehow out of this situation to extract what we need. Nobody said it's easy. Of course, the result is that if you're able to do that, so then you have situation of negativity, situation of positivity, and then what happens is the positive side reveals that the negative side was positive also. The positive side then reveals to you, the experience that you go through on the positive side reveals to you that you couldn't have been there without the negative. The closeness is only experienced because there was a separation before. It's a love that's built on closeness. It never experienced a separation. A love that was never tested by separation, that has no potency. The Kabbalists say that, if you want to try and understand this Kabbalistically, that the root of this idea, the root of this idea of closeness or ultimate oneness, is Hashem's oneness. When you don't have anything prior to or greater than that, which is Hashem's ultimate, all-encompassing oneness. And it seems for some reason, of course we can't understand, we'll begin to understand why, but it seems that for some reason he needed to do that, to manifest that incredible level of his oneness by first breaking it down, if you can speak that way. He first needed to create a world which is not him, as it were. He needed to create a finite world. We don't know why he needed to do that, why he wasn't happy just to be the way he was beforehand and just always be that way. But we see, understand it as we cannot, but we see that's what he did. He somehow, first of all, made a world that's different, that has all the opposite qualities of what he is, the opposite of oneness, pain and suffering, darkness, and somehow that has to reach an elevation back to the oneness of what he is. So it seems that even he, we can speak this way. We can't really speak this way in terms of what he is, but we can speak this way in terms of what he shows us, that we're allowed to do. And we see that what he shows us is a situation where he himself, for the whatever his wisdom saw necessary, created a situation. Yes, the mystics talk about it as a divorce, as an exile. The mystics talk about it as exile. Talk about the Golas Hashkina, that Hashem's somehow sent away his female manifestation. These are very dangerous words to use, and they're very careful about them. But in some sense, there's revealed of Hashem's essence or existence in the world some sort of female level that has an existence of oneness with him. And he sent that away from him in a way, in a sense. He sent that down in some sense to become the world, or to become what's called the Shekhinah, the divine manifestation that's inside the world, before it will spiral back after 6,000 years to form again a oneness where it was in the beginning. I mean, even he somehow went through this experience, which means it must be necessary. And since he's all good and all positive, means that the ultimate positivity has to be revealed. The Zohar says that there's no light except that which shines out of darkness. He just had light in light. He wouldn't perceive light. It couldn't be any revelation of light. This experience of exile, of darkness, there are mystical sources that say that if Adam Arishon had understood, If he simply understood how bad it was, he never would have had to suffer yet. He would never have had to suffer at all. That means, Mufashim say that he found himself in a world, and the reason, the Kabbalistic reason that he needed to be sent out of that garden into an exile situation, and the reason that that exile had to get worse, not just out of the garden, but had to become painful, and eventually had to become brutal, the way we've seen, was because he saw a garden so beautiful, and he saw Hashem's presence so manifest in it, that he didn't understand the pain. He didn't understand that the beauty of a garden, of a world that was perfect, itself is a pain because it's not anymore the all-encompassing oneness that it was before. Just the fact that there's a world created, something that there's now a creator and something created. There's a creator and something, so to speak, outside of him. Even if that thing outside of him is beautiful and perfect and reflective, but nevertheless it's not him. In some way it's a manifestation of something else. Adam Rishon should have grasped his own existence as something other than divine. That means he was somebody, not part of the oneness anymore. And that itself is a divorce. That is an exile. But just that, just not grasping that. So Hashem had to make it more painful. Had to make him feel that not as good as you think. You think it's all fine, this world is beautiful. Put you in a garden, that's all beautiful. I want you to feel that's not perfect at all. That there's a tremendous sadness here. That I am what I am and this world is separate from me. But he didn't feel it. He felt only the beauty of the world that he was in. So then he got separated from that world into a world where he felt the pain more. And my father said, we still didn't experience it. Still didn't understand. And so we had to be brutalized to feel that it's not so good. And we still didn't get the message. We brutalized further. And then the saddest part, of course, is that we still don't realize. The saddest part is we still don't even, we just still don't realize that we're in exile, really. Because we have a slight excuse in this generation. We never knew what it was like any different. Yes, we were born in divorce. We were born in exile. We had never had a love to look back to, so that we can think what it was like at one time to feel the sadness of the separation. So we're not to be blamed to some extent. It doesn't mean we don't have to work to get back to what it was. See if we can try and trace the events that happen at this time of year that reflect this idea. See, what is it exactly? What is the work that has to be done in the darkness? What exactly is the work you have to do while you're going through the time of separation? Rav Albi writes in Alei Shur, he writes that the experience of the Jewish people is the experience of closeness. That's Hashem, that's Torah, that's the Jewish people. It's an experience of closeness. It's us close with Hashem. That's what it is. These 3 weeks, this time of year, this is the time to think about being far. This is the time to experience it. After that, we try and go back in Shiva, we try and go back towards Hashem, we try to feel the closeness. Try like a woman preparing for a wedding, it says. That's the zodiac of the month of Elul, the young unmarried girl. But these 3 weeks we think about not the impending closeness, the marriage, but we think about the distance. And the unique Jewish genius is to be able to feel closeness in distance. To be able to appreciate the fact that there's a distance down, how necessary that is, in order to feel the closeness after. That's not easy at all. Let's see if we can try and work this out a bit together. See, you can look at it in many dimensions. One dimension that maybe goes to the heart, one of the dimensions at the heart of this issue is the issue of emunah, which means faith. It doesn't mean faith. The English word is a hopeless mistranslation, which is guaranteed to give a completely wrong idea of the idea. The idea emunah is commonly translated as faith, but it doesn't mean faith. It means faithfulness. It means loyalty. That's emunah. Emunah means being faithful to something when you can't see it. You don't need to be faithful to something when you see it. So you're with it. Don't take any. The reason that the English mistranslation has crept in is because emunah does have an idea of something to do in the darkness. Something that you can't immediately see now. But the concept is not believing something that you can't know. That's just foolishness. That's being bamboozled and hypnotized. Believing something that can't be known. Might as well be anything. That's not emunah. Emunah is knowing something, but being loyal to it when the thing's not around. That's emunah. That's loyalty, faithfulness. That's what it means, not faith. Faith is just stupidity. Faith means to believe in something that you can't have any knowledge of. So you might as well believe in anything. And people do. That's not the Jewish idea of emunah. Emunah means being faithful to something that has to be, that is known, that is definite. That's not the question. The question is not whether the thing exists or not, whether it's right or not, whether it's this or something else. That's not the question. It's not Jewish history trying to work out what it is or if there is. That's the plague of this generation, that we haven't got a clue. This generation, we don't know anything. But that's not the Jewish idea of Emunah. The Jewish idea of Emunah is that we know exactly what it is that we're missing and what it once was. We know exactly what it is. The only thing is we don't see it right now. We don't experience it right now. It's being faithful to that thing that we don't have right now. It's a separation. It's a relationship. You're not doubting whether another person ever was there. That's not the problem. You know what the love once was and the feelings you still have for that person. The problem is, can you keep that up when you don't see them for year after year after year? See if we can try and examine this. The 3 weeks really stretch between, the 3 weeks are called Bein HaMetzorim. It's Yisigur Bein HaMetzorim. They caught her between the straight, I don't know how you translate it, Metzorim. Metzorim means places of straightness, like places of Mitzrayim. The word Mitzrayim is also, but it means places of squeezing, of limitation. A narrow place. The narrowness, the straightness, the squeezing is between the two ends of these 3 weeks, which is the 17th of Tammuz and the 9th of Av, Tisha B'Av. What happened on these dates? Just trying to understand a little bit one or two of the events that happened on these dates and see what is the root of this tragedy. So the first day that we had yesterday, Sheva Saba Tammuz, that number of things happened on that day, but the heart of it is the breaking of the Luchos, of the tablets. Actually, if you really want to know what it really was, the tablets were broken. Moshe Rabbeinu broke the tablets, the Luchos HaBris, the tablets on which Hashem had written the Torah. He broke them in response to the sin of the golden calf, of the Eagle. That's what happened. So it means that strange twist in Jewish history. That means that the moment when Hashem was giving the Torah to Moshe Rabbeinu, he was handing over the Luchos, at that moment the Jewish people were being unfaithful. At that moment they were busy worshipping the calf. They don't understand what this means. And that ecstasy turned to agony, because the giving of the tablets, Moshe Rabbeinu receiving the Torah on Sinai, that was bringing us back to a situation, it says quite clearly, of Adam HaRishon before the Chait. That means before Adam sinned, the level of closeness and perfection that he was on was reclaimed or regained at that moment when Hashem was giving the Torah. So we were holding at that pinnacle of human existence, and at that instant that it took place already, that's unfortunately, that's the tragedy of Jewish history, is that every moment of perfection was marred in the moment of greatest perfection. It says as we went through the sea, when the sea split, so the people at the back were carrying some sort of idol through the sea, and we're witnessing Hashem splitting the sea, and we're carrying some sort of vessel. It says that when Hashem was giving the Torah at Sinai, completely transcendent experience, they were completely out of their bodies, but nevertheless at that transcendent moment, it says that they managed somehow to be distracted, and they ended up with a piece of gold. I don't understand what this means. Says, like a bride who's unfaithful to her husband under the chuppah. While they're yet getting married, already there's some unfaithfulness, because Hashem is now getting married to us under the mountain, on the mountain, holding the mountain over us. That's a chuppah. And at that moment, at that very moment, in fact, the Chazal say, Medrash says that when Hashem was handing over the luchos, as he was handing over the luchos were six tefachim, it says, six hands breadths. And at the moment Hashem was handing them over, that incredible moment of electricity, there were two hands breadths in Hashem's hands. It says, two tzvachayim beyad Hashem, two hands breadths of the six of the luchos were in Hashem's hands, two were in the middle, and two were in Moshe Rabbeinu's hands. And as Hashem handed them over, at that instant, while Hashem was yet holding, and while Moshe Rabbeinu was holding, and as Hashem was about to release his grasp, I understand these words, as Hashem was about to release his grasp, and Moshe Rabbeinu was about to claim them, at that moment the golden calf took place. That's exactly what happened. And Hashem tried to wrench them back out of Moshe Rabbeinu's hands. And Moshe Rabbeinu grabbed them out of Hashem's hands and overpowered him. So it says in Chazal. Overpowered Hashem and he drew them down. Hashem couldn't hold on. Moshe Rabbeinu took them away. Then when he got down and he saw what was happening, saw what the people were doing, he broke them. He broke them. He had to break them. They were too heavy to hold. Yes, at the moment of perfection, when he was in his strength, he was able to claim them for human beings, for the Jewish people. But when he saw what they'd sunk to, they became too heavy. The letters somehow flew up and the stones crashed. They fragmented. What exactly happened over there? What was the problem? What happened over there? And then there were 3 weeks. At the end of the 3 weeks, not necessarily at the end of the same 3 weeks in history, but what happened on Tisha B'Av 3 weeks later in calendar time was that on Tisha B'Av the spies, the Meraglim, came back from Eretz Israel. The spies were sent into the land to spy it out, to come back and tell the Jewish people what a beautiful land it was. Then they came back and gave a bad report. Lashon Hara, they said the country was bad. They saw people dying there. The people who lived there were giants. You couldn't overcome it militarily. And people sat and cried. That was the night of Tisha B'Av. And Hashem said, because you cried on this night, unnecessarily, I'll make it a night where you have to cry for all of Jewish history. What happened exactly? What went wrong on these occasions? What was our fault exactly? See if we can try and look at it for a few minutes. There's much too much to go into. It's an endless subject, both of these events. But let's try and pick out at least just one dimension of what happened that's linked to the subject of Emunah. See how relevant that is. Let's look at the golden calf. First of all, you have to understand that it's not pitched at our level. That's the classic mistake that people make, especially in this generation. They think that Jewish people who saw Hashem one day, and the next day they bowed down to a piece of gold. Obviously it doesn't make any sense. Can't be understood in that way. We've discussed this in detail on previous occasions, can't go into it fully now, but let's just try and extract the little bit that we need. But you have to understand that even Ezra and other commentaries, they explain that they were not bowing down to a piece of gold worshipping an idol. We understand that generation went out of Egypt was so great. They were the greatest generation that ever lived. They were called Dor Deah. They were the people so high they could know Hashem face to face. A person doesn't see Hashem face to face one day and then worship an inanimate piece of gold the next day, no matter how miraculous it was. Because I'll say that Kabbalistically it was alive. It wasn't just a lump of gold. It was thrown into the fire and it came out alive. Golden calf that was alive somehow. But nevertheless, even that, they'd seen many greater miracles than that. They weren't impressed by that kind of sorcery. They didn't worship it because it had miraculous qualities, magical qualities. In fact, if you would believe that this was a people that merited to receive the Torah and speak to Hashem face to face, and then right after that bow down to a piece of gold, I'm not sure we'd be proud to be descended from such a people. Because it is so bizarre, so absurd, that transition, that there's no way to understand it. And therefore the Mefarshim explains something like this. That the Torah calls it idolatry, because at their level it was. And we've explained this idea before, that every sin in the Torah is always described at the level of greatness of the people involved. The pathetic tragedy of it is to bring it down to our level and imagine that, you know, you wouldn't have done such a thing. Had you been there, yes, had you merited to have Hashem speak to you one day, so you definitely wouldn't have bowed down to a piece of gold the next. They were much greater than we are, there's no question about it, infinitely greater than we are. And they managed somehow to fall into that error. So what exactly was it? So the Mefarshim explains something like this. It says in Medrash, says in Chazal, that what happened was that they had a closeness with Hashem that we can't begin to understand. They followed him out of Egypt, they followed him out of Mitzrayim, they had no food. They had no food. From day to day they had no food. If the manna didn't fall in the morning, it wouldn't have fallen one morning, they would have had nothing. They followed him with a complete emunah. Emunah means trust, like we said before, faithfulness, loyalty. You look after us. We'll leave everything that's familiar to us, we'll follow you in the desert. That's why it says one of the few times, you don't find too often that the Torah praises the Jewish people. You find that it's like a parent who's always criticizing a child to make him better. But one of the few times that it does praise the Jewish people, it says, "Achalti lach chesed nu'reich," I remember to you the kindliness of your youth. "Ahavas klulosayich," the love of your bridal days. That's like a young husband speaking, or an old husband speaking to a wife, remembering the days when they were young. I remember how much in love we were. "Lechteich acharai b'midbar," how you walked after me in a desert, "be'eretz lo zrua," in a land unsown. That means what he remembers of us. This is what Hashem says in one of those few places where his love for us comes through in Tanakh. He describes the Jewish people, the greatness of the Jewish people, that a young bride who is now taken out of a situation of security, at least familiarity, and she walks into a desert where there's nothing at all. Nothing at all. That means, yes, after the first few matzahs were eaten that they took with them, there was no food at all. They went to sleep, they didn't understand that. Imagine you're going to sleep with your family. Send the level of closeness. You've got to sleep with your family and there's no food at all. Nowhere. There's nothing down the road where you can go and buy and pick up some fast food down the road. There is no down the road. You're in the middle of a desert now. You lie down in your tent, there's nothing, there is, never mind an empty fridge, there's no fridge, there's nothing. The children are going to wake up in the morning, there's nothing, nothing at all, no water, nothing, not a glass of water, nothing at all. So even this generation feel a bit insecure if the fridge isn't full enough to go to sleep at night. They went to sleep with nothing at all, starvation facing them the next day, miles and miles from anywhere, days journey from any place. And the next morning they woke up and the manna fell, they went for 40 years, for 40 years they were supported like that. There's an incredible level of emunah, completely dependent on Hashem explicitly all the time. You understand a little bit why they wanted to go back to Egypt a few times, why there were moments of weakness. We find it hard to understand. They want to go back to Mitzrayim. They were slaves there. They were tortured and beaten. Went to sleep having a little bit of food at least. At least some food they knew they'd have the next day. At least they knew what to expect the next day. But to go to sleep in the desert with nothing at all, imagine that feeling, to be so dependent. That's the level that they had. And what happened was that Mephoshim say that their closeness to Hashem was felt through Moshe Rabbeinu. This is a long and detailed subject. We don't have time to go into it fully. But we have a Kabbalistic idea that somehow Hashem's presence manifests itself in the world only through a direct focus. I don't know if you're aware of that idea. There's a Kabbalistic idea that Hashem's Shekhinah, Hashem's presence in the world, again, this is the intimate aspects to the subject that can't be discussed maybe in this kind of forum, but you have to maybe research it yourself. But the closeness is manifest not in general but specifically. I can't be more specific than that. The closeness is manifest specifically. When Hashem manifests in the world, He does not manifest in general. He doesn't speak from everywhere. When Hashem manifests in the world, it said that Sinai had happened like that. But normally when Hashem manifests in the world, it happens through a particular place. Yes, we know that when Hashem spoke, yes, to the Jewish people, it happened through the Mishkan. That sanctuary in the desert, the Jewish people, where did they hear Hashem speaking? They heard Moshe Rabbeinu went inside the sanctuary, inside the Mishkan, the tabernacle. And inside there was a voice, and Hashem spoke. And the voice didn't carry. It was a deafeningly loud voice, but it didn't carry beyond the curtains. It filled the small Kodesh Kodoshim, but beyond the soft curtains it wasn't heard at all. Inside that focus. And later it was heard in the Beis HaMikdash, in the temple. And in the second temple, to the extent that it was. And after that, in fact, the closer, remarkable thing, the Kuzari talks about this also, again I can't go into detail, but the closer the relationship between two people, or the closer the relationship is between Hashem and us, the more specific and tiny is the point of contact where the focus, where the energy flows. There's a chazal that says like this. Please understand this. When our love was strong, so it says, Medrash, when our love was strong, we lay together on the blade of a knife. When our love grew weaker, then a bed of 60 cubits was too small for us. And then when our love grew weaker than that, so it says, Shamayim kisi va'aretz hodom raglai, the heavens are my throne, and the earth is my footstool. That means the separation becomes as great as between heaven and earth. But the idea of it is that when there's a strong love, then there's a willingness to be cramped together in a small space, and you're able to do that. Rabbi Gamal always explains that what this Chazal is telling you is like a marriage. The marriage gets going, the couple in the first beginning of the marriage, the couple are only to be happy to be crowded. No apartment is too small. Yes, the love is so strong, it doesn't matter what the conditions are. The blade of a knife is just fine. But then after a couple of years, you know, he moves into the east wing and she moves into the west wing, and they still cross paths too often, you know. And then after that, the whole thing breaks down. That's the history of our relationship with Hashem. The first time when our love was strong, we met in a Mishkan, a tiny little tent of skins, just a small structure that was in the desert. That was enough. Then our love grew weaker, we moved into Eretz Yisrael. Now it's already a more natural existence. It's not a purely dependent on Hashem. Now there's crops in the field. Now there's an element of the natural. And then we need a Beis HaMikdash much bigger. The Beis HaMikdash, the temple, the place of meetings, a much more elaborate structure. And the second temple, of course, was twice the size of the first. The second Beis HaMikdash was twice the size of the first one. Today, of course, there's nothing that's big enough. The whole world is now, there's no place of meeting at all anymore. That's the idea. So we have a concept that the place of meeting is specific. What was the place of meeting in the desert? Where did Hashem speak from before the Mishkan was built? Through Moshe Rabbeinu, through Moses. Where did we hear Hashem speak from? After Sinai, yes? Where did we meet Hashem? Through the voice, through Moshe Rabbeinu. If he wouldn't have been there, if Moshe Rabbeinu wouldn't have been there, there would have been no place of meeting. He was the agency, he was the voice. It says, Shekhinah medabres mitoch groino shel Moshe. The throat of Moshe Rabbeinu was where the Shekhinah spoke from. We heard Hashem speaking to us through his mouth. So this love, for which they gave up everything, to walk in the desert with no food, with nothing at all, not knowing where they'd be next, when they'd be moving next, what they'd be eating, when they'd be... That love was manifest. They hung on every word, because from his mouth spoke Hashem. What happened? It says he went up the mountain in preparation for receiving the Luchos, and he spent 40 days and 40 nights on the mountain. The people waited. They waited. They sat in the camp and they counted the days anxiously. They had no more revelation. They were lying in darkness, waiting for Moshe Rabbeinu to come down with the Luchos. Yeshua went as far as he could, Joshua. He camped at the border of the mountain, beyond which he wasn't allowed to go. He didn't move from there, and they waited with bated breath for Moshe Rabbeinu to come down. And 40 days later, at the moment that Moshe Rabbeinu was receiving the tablets, at that moment, it says, Vayaram ki boishesh Moshe. Boishesh means he delayed. Moshe Rabbeinu was late coming down. Why was he late? So the Chazal say it means ba'ashesh, coming at the sixth hour. They miscalculated the time. Moshe Rabbeinu told them he would be away for 40 days. And they calculated 40 days, what's called the Eslaish. That means from now, from this hour of the day to the same hour to the same hour, and 40 days passed and he wasn't back. He didn't mean from this hour to that hour, he meant 40 full days. That they'd have to wait until a complete day was passed, until the next day, until the next morning. But they didn't know that, they miscalculated. They calculated the 40 days, 40 strict 24-hour periods. Yes? And when he came back, when he was due back at the sixth hour of the day, according to their calculation, he wasn't back, they panicked. They thought that he wasn't going to make it. They thought this man had been spending 40 days and 40 nights in a world where you don't eat and drink. It says Moshe didn't sleep, he didn't eat and drink, he lived in a transcendent plane. It's very dangerous at that level. The electricity of the spiritual world is very, very dangerous. And at that moment of anxiety, when they thought he wasn't coming down, and they thought that they were alone in the desert and had no more connection with Hashem, and they'd all starved to death right there. And what bothered them wasn't starving to death. What bothered them was the lack, the loss of the love of the connection that they had with Hashem. At that moment it says that their own negativity showed them a vision. It says the Satan, whatever that means, it's part of the energy of negativity in the world, showed them a funeral in Shemaim. Showed them Moshe Rabbeinu being carried on a funeral. Yes, they saw the vayah, they saw Moshe Rabbeinu being carried off to be buried. They saw it with their eyes. So they immediately understood that he died. He hadn't been able to stand the voltage, great as he was. And they were alone. They were alone. And they'd lost it, and they were going to die, and that was that. And the whole history of the Jewish people, the whole future of the world, that was dependent on them, on receiving the Torah and carrying it out, carrying it throughout Jewish history. That was all over now. And that moment of panic, they said to themselves, what do we do in such a desperate situation? Obviously what we do is, before we completely finish, before we die completely, let us make a focus through which Hashem will speak to us again. Let us make an equivalent, yes, let us make an equivalent of Moshe Rabbeinu. And in fact, the irony of it is that if you think about it, they weren't that wrong. They weren't that far wrong. What did they make? They made a golden calf. You know, we think of it as strange. A golden image, a graven image, a sculpture. You know, that's the lowest form of idolatry. But just think about it for a second. Isn't that exactly what they were commanded to? Isn't that almost exactly what they were commanded a short time later? When in fact they were given the Torah. Weren't they told to make a golden image of Kruvim? Weren't they told that they had to take the Aron of the Torah and on its lid, make a lid of two golden Kruvim sort of angels with children's faces, graven image, and from between them Hashem would speak to them? They were so close. You realize that the crude way it's taught in Cheder, no, traditional Jewish education, is that they're such ungrateful people, that they're so fickle, they worship Hashem one day, they're a piece of gold the next day. That's not fickle, that's psychotic. But I understand, is that what happened was they almost twigged it, they almost sensed, they were almost sensitive enough to virtually work out what Hashem wanted. The proof is that shortly after that, as I said, that's exactly what they were told to do, virtually, almost. It wasn't a calf, but it was gold, and it was an image, and Taka, that's where Hashem spoke to them from. So what was so bad about it? It was a desperate, last-ditch attempt to retain the relationship, to make something that Hashem should speak from. Far cry from the coarse and crude version of idolatry that we usually understand. So what was wrong with it? What was wrong? After all, they saw Moshe Rabbeinu, saw him die, and they had to try and recapture that relationship, and so they made something. So there's a big debate in Chazal. There's opinions that say that, why did they make a calf? Why a calf? Why the image of an ox? Sure. Then Mephoshim say that when they saw Hashem's presence at the sea, when they were standing at the Red Sea, it says, and they saw Hashem's Merkava. The Merkava means the chariot. Again, the English words are so battered into Christological and un-Jewish meanings that, but they saw some spiritual vision, they sensed some spiritual manifestation that we call the Merkava. The Merkava, in English it means a chariot, but it does not mean a chariot. It means a vehicle on which Hashem's presence rides in the world. It means Hashem's presence manifests. When they saw him manifest at the sea, they saw him manifest on this vehicle. On this, whatever this manifestation is. And what is it? As I'll say, it has four corners. It's four corners of the Merkava. One is the face of a human, one is the face of an eagle, one is the face of a lion, and one is an ox. You're sure? The left hand side, the side of strength, let's say. That's the side of shore, of an ox. So what were they doing? They were trying to think, at that desperate moment when they saw Moshe Rabbeinu disappear, they saw him about to be buried. They were completely alone. They had no voice of Hashem to speak to them. They thought, what was the last time we saw Hashem speak to us on an image, on something that has a form in the world, Let's pick something from Merkava. Wouldn't that be obvious? What would you expect them to pick? They saw Hashem ride on this thing once before. So let's build an aspect of the thing that Hashem rides on. Let's take one of the elements that carries His presence in the world. What could be more logical? So Chazal say, what's logical about it is that many different interpretations, but the theme that we're working on this evening is that, understand this, they chose one manifestation of Hashem's presence. In other words, there were four, they chose one. What's the problem? The problem is that you're now worshipping, as it were, you're now relating to one of Hashem's midas. The ox is really, the shor is really the powerful side, the left-hand side, it's called the female side, side of power. And that means that they were now relating or making even just a channel for Hashem, but a channel that is an aspect of Hashem's presence, not the totality. Not believing in the oneness of Hashem. Not relating to the oneness on a very, very subtle level. A very subtle level. You could maybe say the Kruvim, the two golden angels that we eventually put on the Aron, that was right and left together. It says when our relationship between us and Hashem was pure, the two Kruvim were locked in embrace. They were loving each other. That the unity, yes, what looks like disparate part of reality forming a unity, but they didn't do that. They created something which was just one aspect of Hashem's manifestation, which is a lack of relating to Hashem directly. It's a relating to one aspect of what Hashem is. Sounds very subtle to us what the problem was, but as I'll say, it's a lack of emunah, lack of faith. It's a lack of loyalty to Hashem as He is, to break it down to one aspect, and that to them, for them at that level, that was called idolatry. Whether it was the one aspect of it, whether it was in general we understand, they should have waited. They should have relied on Hashem. That's what Emunah means. He took them out of Mitzrayim. Yes, they were waiting. Moshe Rabbeinu said he'd come back. You don't understand what's happening. You think he's late. You miscalculate. You think you're correct. That's what loyalty is all about. Loyalty is not when things are going the way you think they should be going. Not loyalty. That's just common sense. When everything's going the way it was planned, you don't need any loyalty then. You just need common sense. That's not a test of Emunah. Loyalty, emunah, is tested when things aren't going the way you think they should. That's when we see whether you have faithfulness, whether you have emunah. And that was their test. The test of emunah was the time ran out. They saw Moshe Rabbeinu die. Looked desperate. Yeah, they were cast into the aversion of the 3 weeks. They were cast into aversion. In fact, exactly what it was, the beginning of the 3 weeks, that's what it was. The test of the 3 weeks, the test of the darkness, is to see the light in the darkness. That's what it is. Not to see the darkness in the darkness. The test of it is to carry on seeing the light. When you see, when the light manifests and you carry on seeing it, it's not in mono, you're just looking. But when the light goes and you still remember how the light was and you function that way, that's in mono, and that's where they fail. That's their great level. With all the justification in the world that it was pikuach nefesh and that they were saving their lives and that's why they put aside the commandment of not exactly making an image but with very good reason and their lives depended on it. At their level, at their great intense level of spirituality, it was a failing. It was a failing in mono. Failing in mono. And because of that, Chazal say that there isn't a sin in the world, there isn't a tragedy in the world that isn't linked to that tragedy. Not a single tragedy that's happened since then is unlinked. That is, every single tragedy that's happened was linked to that tragedy of breaking the Lufes, which was the result of the sin that the Jews did by relating to this eagle. What happened 3 weeks later? Again, not 3 weeks necessarily in the same year. But what happened on Tisha B'Av? The spies were sent into Eretz Israel. They were sent in to see the land. Here the Mephoshim say that already the mistake was made of looking into the natural. They were sent, instead of relying on Hashem, what do you have to send spies for? Hashem takes you out of Mitzrayim and He says to you that you're going to a land that's perfect. You have to send spies to see if it is so. Why do you have to send spies in the first place? They're shlach lecha, sent for you. Mephoshim said that the Jewish people approached Moshe and they came to him berbuvia, that means they all came in a muddle, and they said to him, we need to check it out, we need to send spies. So Moshe Rabbeinu thought for a moment and Mephoshim say, God, see, they all knew they didn't have to check it out. Everybody knew. Hashem said it's good. What's the problem? And if you think that they doubted that militarily they could defeat the enemies there, they just wiped out people. They wiped out kings. You have to understand that when they arrived at the borders of Eretz Yisrael, what was their hesitation that they wouldn't win a military victory with Hashem behind them? Everything they'd won in the desert all the way, all the people they defeated had been victories that were purely spiritual. It says they killed Og, for example. Og Melech HaBoshem. Og Melech HaBoshem was, again, we brought up in a generation where we think these things sound strange. Og was a giant of proportions. How big was Og? It says when he's a baby, his crib was 60 amas. his back, his crib, 60 elders is 30 meters. 30 meters was his crib when he was newborn. Right? That's how he looked when he was newborn, right? So even if you don't want to shoot up a chazanish, you know, but he says, so 25 meters. He was enormous. It says that when he saw the Jewish people in the desert, he picked up a mountain that was as long as the camp, and he tried to dash it down on the Jewish people. They were going to wipe out the Jewish camp entirely with one movement. And Moshe Rabbeinu had to go out and battle him. Moshe Rabbeinu was 10 amos tall, 5 meters. 5 meters, Moshe Rabbeinu. And Og was, how tall was Og? So the Chazal say that Moshe Rabbeinu was 10 amos tall. He leapt in the air 10 amos, and he had in his hand a staff of 10 amos, and he hit him on his ankle, says Chazal. That's it. But yeah, 15 meters in the air. It reached his ankle, ultimately, and that brought him crashing down. That brought him crashing down. So that wasn't a battle, that wasn't miraculous. They hadn't defeated people like that. What were they worried about? So they were giants in Israel, nothing new. What was the problem? But they nagged and they said, so the people started thinking, and it says in Chazal, Moshe Rabbeinu thought himself. You have an obligation to act in the natural. We know that. It's a Jewish obligation. We've spoken about it here before. You don't rely on miracles. We don't rely on miracles. You have to act in the natural. You must make an effort. So maybe we should send spies. At least it looks natural. That was the thinking. At most, that was the thinking. There's other explanations. Other explanations, but to send spies to see if they could do it. Well, it wasn't a military effort anyway. It was all emunah. Especially in that generation. And what happened? So already there was an inkling, and they went too far. They went too far. They made more of an effort than was necessary. Moshe Rabbeinu said, why do you need this? Hashem is telling us that it's fine. We don't need this effort. No, they pleaded, they nagged, they felt it was necessary. Moshe Rabbeinu gave in. So what was he giving into? What were they demanding? Lack of emunah. They were demanding that instead of just going purely with Hashem, what Hashem says is fine. Don't have to worry about it. We got the credentials already. We have his credentials. We've met him already. We know what he's capable of. Now we'll rely on our own effort. We'll make our own plan. We'll make our own plan with the eagle. Yes, Hashem is letting us down. Moshe Rabbeinu is dying. We'll take matters into our hands. You don't have to take matters into your hands. He's reliable, Hashem. Yes, he's never let us down. We've let him down, but he's never let us down. You can rely on him. No, we won't rely on him. We'll take matters. What happened? They went into Israel, and of course, once you go in like that, it's doomed. Once you go in like that, relying on you, so they're definitely going to see everything wrong. And that's what it says. They went into Israel. They saw everything wrong. What happened was the story of human existence. They went into Eretz Yisrael. It was a time when people were dying. It says the Meraglim, the 12 of them, they walked through the land and they saw people dying. The country was full of funerals. They walked around Israel and they saw the inhabitants of the land burying each other. Full of funerals. People were dying. So they came back and they said, it's a country that kills its inhabitants. You can't live there. All we saw was funerals. And Moshim say, you know why there were funerals? So Hashem caused everyone to die then. Actually, a Kabbalistic explanation that they died because they were faced with the presence of the Meraglim. That is, when people of great spiritual stature enter a place, then they show up the people who are not of spiritual stature, and that's what killed them. Anyway, the point is that these people who weren't worthy of living there, right, when confronted with the spiritual greatness of these incredible Jews, leaders of the Jewish people, what happened is they died like flies. They started dying. Why did Hashem arrange it that way? Why did he allow that manifestation to happen? So the Chazal say quite clearly, to protect the Jews. When 12 spies are walking around the land, and people have their eyes peeled, for foreigners and for spies and for military threats. So their lives would have been in danger. So Hashem caused them to be busy with burying each other. He caused them to be so busy with mourning for each other and go to funerals. They didn't have time to notice. Their minds weren't on noticing a few strangers who were wandering through the country. So what do you see? You see that really what was happening was Hashem's chesed. Hashem was causing an event to happen that would protect the Jewish people. But once your mind's not set that way, once you're not set in emunah, once you don't see what Hashem is doing for you, you see the side of darkness. You see, if you go in and you have your mind set on emunah and you wish to see what you wish to see, so then you only see the good side. That's how life is. You're only tuned to seeing. If you're tuned to emunah, you see Hashem everywhere. If you're not tuned to emunah, you'll never see it. And they weren't. They were tuned already at the wrong wavelength. They went in thinking, again on their incredible level, we can't criticize them at our level. They went in thinking of their own prowess and power. And then they saw. Emunah requires that a person be tuned correctly. See, everything. Once Rabbi Dessler was explaining. Once a great Rabbi Dessler was explaining a group of people, and there were one or two people there who weren't perhaps that involved, or weren't that imbued with Torah. The person who was a businessman had come to the shiur. And Rabbi Dessler was explaining that it says that the tzitzis that we wear, The tzitzis has to have a thread of tcheles. We don't have that color today, so we're not able to wear it. But there's one thread of tcheles, which is the color of the horizon. That's what you have to have, a certain kind of blue that's the color of the horizon. And it says in Gemara, it says in Chazal, the reason is because when you see that color, in the tzitzis it reminds you of the sea. The sea reminds you of the horizon reminds you of the sea, that reminds you of the sky, that reminds you of the Kisei HaKovod, Hashem's throne of glory. That's why you wear tchelis, because it will, by a chain of association, it will take your mind into a place of Kedusha. You'll remember Hashem, you won't do anything wrong. You'll see the tchelis, it'll remind you of the sea, that'll remind you of the horizon, the sky, that'll remind you of the Kisei HaKovod, for sure. So this person was a bit skeptical. He was a bit skeptical. He said to Rabbi Dessler, are you serious? Because I see a blue thread on my tzitzis and I think about Hashem? You want to tell me that? Let's be realistic for a second, yes? Let's be realistic. Person looks at a horizon colored, yes, a blue, a sea green, blue colored thread on his tzitzis. Now that's going to cause him automatically to go through a chain of association, automatically think about Hashem? You can understand, he's surprised, this man. So my Dessler said something, apparently this man, they say, he had a very strong reaction. My Dessler said to him, why does it say in Halacha that a man shouldn't look at certain garments of women, even if the woman's not in there, you understand? Why shouldn't? Because by association. Person will think of things that he shouldn't think of. So Rabbi Dessler, so you look at some garments, you're going to start making associations? So it depends where your mind is. Depends where your mind is. Depends how your mind's tuned. If your mind's tuned on a certain wavelength, then it doesn't matter what you see, you're going to make the right associations. But if your mind's tuned the other way, it doesn't matter what you see, also make the right associations. The mitzvah of tchelis that we have. In fact, it's remarkable because in the Torah it's put very close to the meraglim. In the same parsha we read about the tzitzis, the color of the tzitzis, and we read about the meraglim. And Chazal say that it's to show you exactly that. Exactly to show you how to see correctly. But you only see correctly when you tune correctly. A person is tuned correctly. A person is in love, let's say. Somebody loves somebody else very dearly. But anything reminds you of that person. If you had explained to somebody else what it was that happened that triggered an association, I'll think you're crazy. It depends what you're tuned to. It depends what's all-encompassing in the mind. The person is tuned to Kedusha, so of course the color will remind him of Hashem. Anything will. So once you see the meraglim went in, they went in there not tuned in that way. It says after your heart and after your eyes. That's what it says. Because the way the heart is tuned, that's the way the eyes see. So they went in tuned to we looking at what's going on. Now you see people dying, you see tragedies. Show the natural explanation. Show the natural explanation that it's a tough land, people die here. But the supernatural explanation is, Hashem's doing this to save us. That's the opposite pole of the spectrum. But that's the way a Jew's supposed to think. You're supposed to see the Hashkocha when it looks dark. You see death and destruction around you, you're supposed to see the Hashkocha that looks after you. So what happened? They got it wrong. Because of a wrong fine-tuning in Emunah. Instead of relying on Hashem, they were relying on themselves at that level of subtlety that was expected from them at their level of greatness. So they came out and they said it's a difficult land, we can't conquer it. Already speaking in terms of what we can do. It's not what Hashem can do, what we can do. And because of that they cried, the Jewish people cried, and Hashem said, because of that, this night of crying will be a night of crying for all your generations. And what was the correction? What happened? Understand this very, very amazing thing. Do you know what the Jews tried to do? If you're aware, the Torah says that right after that, the next day, or right then and there, there was a case of a group of people called the Ma'apilim. The Ma'apilim were people who tried to correct the situation. They decided to attack the country. They saw what had happened. They saw everybody crying. They saw the misery. They saw that they had completely lost it. They had caused a terrible, terrible sin, that they had spoken badly about the land of Israel. They had lost their faith. They had lost their munah. They decided the only way to correct it was to go in now. Logical, isn't it? Hashem says go in, and we held back, we didn't want to go in, and Hashem says you failed, so let's correct it, let's go in. So they got up and they tried to take the country by force. They tried to march in by force, and Moshe Rabbeinu said don't do it, because Hashem is not with you. Hashem's not with you. The Aron didn't move from the camp. Hashem is not with you. Hashem doesn't want you to go now. It's too late. He doesn't want you to go. So they said no, we're going anyway, and they attacked Eretz Yisrael, and they were all defeated, all destroyed, completely destroyed. It says Ara Chorma, they were completely wiped out, they were destroyed. And Bavalbi says, Mephoshim say, very, very interesting. Why did they try and do this? Why were they disobedient? Why did they try and enter the land by force? They knew Hashem had said no. But they thought they were doing an Avayim Lishmo. They thought that they were doing a sin they thought that they had, when Hashem had wanted them to go in, they'd said no. So now when Hashem says don't, we must yes. That was the thinking. You follow? The only way we can correct such a terrible sin is to exactly do the opposite. When Hashem said, please go in, I'll look after you, we lacked faith, we said no. So now when Hashem says, I won't look after you, well, Shem will do it anyway. And that will reinstate, you follow? That will reinstate us. But of course, this logical God is exactly the opposite of what they should have done. Because what was their fault in the first place? Their fault in the first place was relying on themselves. Was relying on their decision and not relying on Hashem. So now what was the error? The error was saying, okay, we'll take matters into our hands. We'll go in now. Yes, we'll show Hashem how strong we are. In Emunah, of course, definitely. But the way we see it, exactly the wrong response. The right response is, you've made a mistake and Hashem is telling you that the way to handle it now is not to go. That would have been the correct response. And of course they were destroyed because. We see from this that this terrible time in Jewish history, this time of darkness, was caused by a darkness that the Jewish people caused themselves. That means that when there was a loyalty that should have been manifest, when we were given an ordeal, so we didn't show that emunah. We didn't show that loyalty. We were left in the desert, seemingly alone. That's the time for emunah. When it looks dark and everything looks hopeless, that's the time for emunah. That's an insight, that's the ordeal. When we're brought to Eretz Israel and we should rely on Hashem, that's the time for emunah to rely on Him. He says, go in, it'll be fine. We didn't rely on Him, we relied on us. When you rely on you, so then you shrink yourself to human dimensions. And all you have to rely on is human dimensions. And we know exactly how powerful those are, how weak they are. The concept of emunah is that, yes, it says that Ne'eman, it says that Hashem is considered Ne'eman. It says, you know, a remarkable thing, you have to understand this. Emunah, it says, She'he'emin be'olamo ibroi, that Hashem believed in His world and created it. That Hashem had emunah in the world. What does that mean? That Hashem had emunah in His world. He had faith in His world and created it. We're supposed to have faith in Him. He has faith in us. That doesn't mean faith, belief, you know. I'm not talking about Hashem believing that we're here. The point is that He has faith. Faith means He relies on us. We rely on Him, He relies on us. This emunah is a two-way street. You only get Hashem relying on us if we rely on Him. Isn't that what a love is? Isn't that what it means, a complete trust in a relationship? Chazal say that where it says, B'chol Beisi Ne'emanu, that Hashem says about Moshe Rabbeinu, that He's trust Ne'eman. He's Ne'eman in my whole house. What's that mean? B'chol Beisi Ne'eman, that means Hashem says about Moses, about Moshe Rabbeinu, that He's trusted in my whole house. What is Hashem's whole house? Hashem's whole house is all of creation. Trusted in my whole house means He can go anywhere. No matter how intimate, no matter how hidden, no matter where it is, He can go anywhere. That means Moshe Rabbeinu has the power to do whatever He wants with the creation. That's how Hashem trusts us. When Hashem gives us the Torah, it means that He's giving Himself. He's giving Himself to be done with whatever we want. Unbelievable idea. It says that Hashem trusts Himself to us. The concept of trust, my Rebbe once said, it's like a person you trust, what means Ne'eman, Ne'eman bepikdoinoi, it says. Ne'eman bepikdoinoi, that means he's trusted, faithful with his deposit. It means, the idea of emunah means a person whom you can trust with something that's so precious to you, that if that thing disappeared, you'd have no hope left. The person is trustworthy means you can give it to this person and no matter when you come back, no matter how long it's been, no matter what confusion has arisen, the thing will be there for you. It may be a secret, a person you can entrust with a secret, that if this thing gets out in the wrong place, there's no life left for you. To be faithful, to be trustworthy means a person who can hold that priceless possession, whether it's a possession, whether it's a secret, whatever it is. And it will be as dear to that person as life itself. That's what it means. That's the way Hashem treats us. He gives His Torah to Moshe Rabbeinu. He gives His Torah to the Jewish people. He makes Himself dependent on us. And the Hashem say quite clearly, if we keep Him out of the world, He's out of the world. If we mess up His creation, if we keep Him out of it, if we destroy the whole thing, so we can destroy the whole thing. He's trusted us with it. No more than expects us to trust Him. The response we're supposed to have is, Hashem, never mind us, we trust You. You're okay by us. We, never mind entrusting us with manipulating creation. We appreciate, we understand that You've done that with us. We'll do that to You. Now the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, the Gemara says, who has no share in the world to come? The Gemara starts like this. The Mishnah says, Kol Yisrael Yeshlem Chalek Lamaba. Every Jew has a place in the world to come. Non-Jews also, I'm not going to go into it. Every Jew has a place in the world to come. Then the Gemara says, and who has no place in the world to come? And then it lists some people. And one of those is a person who doesn't believe in it. You hear that? A person who doesn't believe in it, that's what it says. Somebody does not believe in Tzchias HaMaasim. Somebody does not believe in the resurrection. Somebody who doesn't believe in the world to come, he has no share in the world to come. Says the Gemara, why? Kevan Shekofa b'Tzchias HaMaasim. Since he denied the resurrection and the next form of existence, lo yelo chalek Tzchias HaMaasim. You won't have a share in it. Why? Says the Gemara, ki kol midas HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because all of the conduct of Hashem is midah keneged midah. Everything that Hashem does is measure for measure exactly. He didn't believe in it, he won't have it. Now you have to think about that for a second. Person doesn't believe means he won't have it. But one second, I behaved correctly. I did all the mitzvahs. I did all the mitzvahs. I did everything Hashem asked of me. I just didn't believe that there's another existence after this. That denies an existence there. This person wouldn't have a share. Again, how is not believing in it? How is that measure for measure? You have to, measure for measure would be that if a person wants to live in the next world, he must build the next world. And if he breaks down the next world, but what's believing in it have to do with it? What's belief? Are we together? If there's something behind that partition that I can't see, whether I believe in it or not, it has to do with whether it's there or not. Are we together? If there's a world around the corner that I can't see, and I have a share in that world guaranteed to me, and it's real and objective and it's absolutely there, so I don't believe in it, what's that make any difference? If there was something that I couldn't see in the next room and I didn't believe, it wouldn't affect it one bit. So how come if I have a share in the next world and I just don't happen to believe it? You see that emunah is not just a believing whether something is or isn't. You see, emunah is a force that creates the thing. That's what you see. That means if you don't rely on him, if you don't rely on it, the only way you get there is by the reliance. The only way that he creates his world is because he entrusts it to us. You know, the first word in the Torah, Anochi, the Ten Commandments, Anochi. The Gemara says that if you read the word Anochi, it's Anochiko. Anochiko means that the first letters, the letters of that word, spell out the sentence. And the Gemara says that the sentence that's spelled by the word Anochi, Anochi means I myself. And the Foshim say that the word Ani in Hebrew means me with relation to you. But Anochi means me as I am. Which means that Hashem's name, that I, what I actually am in my own essence, stands for Ana Nafshi Ksivas Yehivas. I have written myself and given it to you. You hear that? That's what the word Anochi means. That I've taken myself and written myself down and given myself. That's what the Torah is. It means Hashem has given himself to us, now do with it what you want. But I'm trusting you. And if you trust me, then I'll be here for you. If you don't trust me, it doesn't exist for you. You see that the concept of emunah that we have as a Jewish people, the difference between our emunah and the emunah of the world, you know why they translate? Do you know why the non-Jewish world translates the concept of emunah as faith? Because to them it's a concept whether you believe in it or not. That's what it is. It's something that you don't know and you choose to believe or you don't believe. That's what it is. Not intrinsically connected to me. But the Jewish concept of emunah has nothing to do with that you believe or not. The Jewish concept of emunah is that you form it by believing in it, not by being loyal to it, by relying on it, by allowing it to rely on you, by being completely faithful to it. You create a whole new dimension, you create a whole new space. It says that the first father of the Jewish people, Avraham, yes, Abraham, Avraham Avinu, was a great man of emunah, that's what it says. Behem in Bashem, it says. He believed in Hashem. Again, the English word is nonsense, and he believed. It means he was loyal, even when he couldn't see him. Even before he ever saw him, he was loyal to him. Vayashavelo itzdoko, and Hashem considered it to him tzdoko. He believed in Hashem. What does it mean that he believed in Hashem? What does it mean exactly? So the Kabbalists say it doesn't mean that he sort of got an idea, that he sort of got a fixed, you know, a fixed belief in his head that there was such a thing. That's not what it means. It means that he created a whole new form of existence. He created, it says, Vayetzo Eisa Achutz, Hashem took him outside. The Kabbalists say that when Hashem took him outside, it doesn't mean he took him out of his tent. We aren't concerned where Hashem spoke to him. Whether it was in his tent or outside makes no difference to us. Taking him outside means he took him outside the system. He took him outside of all existence that was familiar to all other people. He took him completely outside that form of existence. He was a man of emunah. That means he was a man that Hashem could rely on. And since Hashem saw he could rely on him, the fact that he could rely on him formed a whole new existence. And that's the existence of the Jewish people. It's an existence that's in a whole new dimension. Where's that place? Where's that other dimension? Where's that place? It's here. Not some other place. Where are the people who are not alive now? Where are the people who are not alive now? Where are those neshamas? Where are they exactly? You ask most people, they'll tell you, far away. Wherever the furthest place they can think of. And how would we make contact with them? Do they picture them flying? How many hours flying time? A bit more, a bit less. That's not where they are. They're here. the neshamas of people who are not alive anymore, they're out here. They're not next to us, they're inside of. They're in exactly the same place. There's a different level of existence. Two different kinds of existence that don't impinge on each other. Two different kinds of dimension have nothing to do with each other. This world that we experience in the world of Emunah, it's the same place. Exactly the same place. But it's a different kind of reality. If you're the kind of person who can be relied on, you're a different kind of human being. If you're the kind of person who can't be relied on, you're not human. That's the nature of the Emunah of the Jewish people. So the fault is Emunah. The fault is relying on ourselves, breaking down in a test, in an ordeal when things are dark. It says, Lahagid baboker chasdecho, to say your chesed, Hashem, your kindness in the mornings, ve'emunascha balelos, and to say your emuna at night time. Isn't that amazing? That's what we say in the davening. Lahagid baboker chasdecho, to talk about your chesed. Chesed means your kindliness that manifests to us. The good times that we see, that we say in the morning. Morning in Hebrew, boker in Hebrew, people think it means the morning. But boker means the time when things are clear. Levaker means in Hebrew, levaker means to check out a thing clearly. I don't know if you're aware of that. Erev, nighttime, is la'arev. La'arev in Hebrew means when things mix together, the irbuvia, you can't tell one thing from another. Evening time means when the shadows and the reality become intertwined and you can't tell them. Boker in Hebrew means when two things are levaker, bikoret. Bikoret means something that's critically separated that you can tell. Bikur doesn't mean a visit, by the way. People think that bikur means a visit. Bikur cholim means to visit the sick. It doesn't. It means to check out what he needs. That's bikur cholim. I don't know if you know that. Morning is a time when things are crystal clear. Bikuret is. So lahagid baboyke chazdecho. In the time of day, or in the time of Jewish existence, not only the time of day, it's also the daytime of Jewish history. In the time of day when the light is clear, and when we see Hashem's existence clearly. So then we talk about chesed. Chesed is the love, the kindliness that flows, the sensitivity, that's easy. But in the nights when things are dark, and you don't see anything, then only emunah functions. You see, we've so lost this, we don't even have the mashal anymore. You see, if you lived in a generation where there were no lights, if you lived in a generation where there were no lights, today we don't have night time. We don't know what night really is. This generation, no, people who grow up in this world, they don't know what light, what nighttime really is. Because what we do is now we switch on the light and an artificially lit form of the daytime. But if you've ever been in a place where there are no lights, yes, and there's no moon, and you're out in the country, in a bush, where there's nothing at all to see, and you can't see as far as your nose, you suddenly become aware in that moment that you can't even be sure that you exist. In that moment when you can't see anything, you've got no point of reference at all. That's the fear of the nighttime, by the way. That's the innate fear of the night time. Why do people have this fear of the night time? Why is that? It's not just a childish, it's a reality. Why is there a fear of the night? Because in the night time you have no point of reference to reassure you about existence. The only way you know you are in a night like that, when you have nothing that can be felt or seen, is because you have an inner knowledge that you are. That's emunah. That inner knowledge, that dust, that's emunah. Emunah is in the time, in the night time, when you can't even feel. And isn't that this generation? This generation does, never mind, doesn't know about Hashem. This generation doesn't know that everything's real. This generation is so bamboozled that people aren't aware whether they're Jewish or being Jewish or not being Jewish, whether there's any difference in it, being human or not being human. What exactly does this generation know? What does the enlightened Western technical scientific mind exactly know in this generation? Think about it. Isn't it embarrassing? Does he know that being Jewish makes any difference to not being Jewish? Definitely not. Definitely. Massive intermarriage rate. Not a vague conception of what it means to be Jewish. Does this Western, technically skilled, scientific mind even know what the difference is between human and being an ape? Definitely not. Convinced he's a monkey. The whole philosophy built on it. How do you expect him to be able to tell the difference between a Jew and a non-Jew if he can't tell the difference between a human and an animal? Isn't that this generation? Where exactly is his emunah? Can be here. That kind of person can be relied on? A person who's grown up in the lap of this kind of culture. This Western, slick, sophisticated, scientific mind. Such a person can be relied on? You'd rely on such a person with your secret? You'd give this kind of person, yes, you'd give him your Torah? Would you give him your Torah? Would you give him your secret? Would you give him the secret of your life, on which your life depends? Would you put one of your fragile, sensitive arteries into his hand? This person who doesn't even know, can't even tell whether he's human or not? Thinks he's a more sophisticated version of what was once swinging in the trees? So it's no wonder that he doesn't know whether he's Jewish or not. And it's no wonder that he can't be relied on. Is that this generation? Well, who can be relied on anymore? Can friends be relied on? Does anybody even put any energy to being a friend anymore? Being a friend means somebody can be relied on. No matter what, how much time has gone by, no matter what's happened, that person can be relied on. Today, children can't rely on their parents. Today, children can't rely on their parents will still be there for them. Children today, the consciousness, a child is 6, 7, 8, 10 years old, he's aware that the friends in his class, the parents aren't even there for them. 50% of the children in his class, the parents just aren't there anymore. You can't rely on your parents anymore. You expect them to have Emunah and Hashem. That's the problem. That's the problem. The way out of the problem is to strengthen Emunah. It's to live in that other dimension. There's no other way. Strengthening the practical and the technical, that's not going to do it. Trying to correct what happened in these 3 weeks. If we have to try and correct what happened in a time when we were busy with what we shouldn't have been busy with, instead of relying on Hashem and waiting and relying on Him. Asher he'emin bo'olamo, that He trusted in His world, that He wants us to trust in Him. That we know what He is and what He's done for us. And we lived with that knowledge for centuries. To simply live with those facts, that's all it is. Not to try and take matters into our hands and start deciding. To let Him speak. And to live up to the loyalty that He expects from us. And when that period ends, that's a period 3 weeks later, that ends with having to go and check it out for yourself and see what you think of it. Or how you're going to take care of problems, your problems, other people's. That's not what's called for. That's not what's needed. That's not loyalty. So it comes out that this is an experience for us of ordeal, of trial. We're given the time of darkness for us to make the light shine. We're given 3 weeks of darkness to work in Emunah in the 3 weeks so that the 7 weeks are light that we shine. To be given light from the beginning is no test, and I love that book in that kind of a situation. The only way that the world can be built. The Kabbalists say that there was a breakdown in the cosmic structure before the world began, and the world is a corrected version of the broken down version. And when did it happen, funnily enough? When was that ultimate crash? The mystics say that before the world was formed, there was a mystical crash in which, whatever it means, broken pieces fell down to the abyss. It's from some spiritual height, the broken pieces of the vessels fell to an abyss. Where is the bottom of that abyss? Here. That's what they say. This is the bottom of the abyss where the broken pieces fell. On what day was it? What date of the year was it? The Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av in the year before the world was created, in case you trace time back before the 6 days of creation. It was a year before that 6 days began. On Tisha B'Av of that year, the spiritual world collapsed. What does that mean? Hashem had to collapse the world. There wasn't anybody to mess it up for Him. He wasn't the first human who blew it. He himself messed it up in some way. He let it crash, whatever that means. Yes, because the world can only be built out of a broken down form. Only if there's been darkness before. Kina falti comes, because I fell, I've arisen. Doesn't mean because I fell, I've got up. Because I fell down, I got up. Despite falling, I got up. Because I fell, I'm able to arise. Because I sat in darkness, Hashem orli, Hashem is light for me. That's what it means. So it means that we only get to Elul, to Rosh Hashanah, to Yom Kippur, to Sukkot, we only get to that beautiful time of closeness, to that tabernacle of the Sukkot, eventually. We only get through that time of closeness if we know how to go to the darkness. And the biggest tragedy that we could do is to reenact that tragedy of falling in Emunah, of lacking faith when things get tough. That's exactly what's expected from us. To keep the faith, like it, baboyke chazdecho, to be able to talk about Hashem's chesed when everything's going fine. And when we see Hashem the way we saw Him in some generations gone by, and everything in our lives is going well. That's not what's being requested from us. What He wants in these 3 weeks now is to be able to see the light despite the darkness. It's to be able to know that He can be trusted. And if anybody can be trusted, if anything in the world can be relied on, it's Him. That's what's required from us. To be able to experience correctly, and even more than that, to know what it means, ומנוס חבלת.